Lecture 11, Aeschylus or Astaea.
In our last lecture, we discussed the book of Job in the Hebrew Old Testament, a work composed around 500 BC in the form that we have it today. And we explored, within the framework of Job, the theme of fate and of good and evil. In other words, why do things happen to us? And can the things that happen to us be called absolutely good or absolutely evil? Or is it all just a matter of circumstances? We also asked the question about the connection between public and private morality. In other words, what a ruler does or what a nation as a nation does, can it be separated from the private acts of individual leaders or even individual citizens? Which is what we say today, isn't that correct? We very much separate what a politician does in his or her private life from their public policy. We just don't want them put together at all, and I think as a nation we have made that decision. Even on the whole, as we have made the decision that there is no such thing as absolute good and absolute evil, it simply depends upon the circumstances. And those are perfectly reasonable conclusions to reach as individuals and as nations. But for the Greek, as for the Hebrew, this question of public and private morality, of good and evil, and of fate, lay at the wellsprings of some of the most creative works of literature ever produced. And at the same time that the poet of the book of Job was pondering the question of good and evil and fate, the Athenian playwright Aeschylus, born in 525, who would live on to 456 BC, was composing his magnificent work, the Orestia. Produced, in fact, in 458 BC, it is one of the most profound statements of the question of what is good and what is evil, and it is one of the most magnificent examples of Athenian drama, of the Athenian tragedy. And that tragedy was the characteristic cultural statement of the Athenian democracy. As you know, who have gone with me through famous Greeks or a history of freedom, the Athenians of the 5th century BC were the first democracy in history. They were a democracy based upon the ideal of the greatest good for the greatest number of citizens. And they had a set of values, including a free market economy, including the protection of the rights of individual citizens, that is very similar to the values of our own American democracy. And having imposed upon themselves this awesome responsibility of self-government, they chose to develop a forum for the public discussion of fundamental values, asking themselves the same questions we asked last lecture. Is there a set of universal values which must guide us? And basic to that concept is, do you have free will? Or is everything fated to happen to you and you cannot change it? To Aeschylus, that got to the very heart of the question of good and evil and of how to live your life. What do you think? Is everything fate, or do you have the chance to shape your own life? Do you have free will? Because if you don't have free will, then it is very difficult to take responsibility. After all, Job could say, God sent this upon me. Muhammad was quite clear, everything that befalls us is destined by God. It's not that simple to Aeschylus. Like all of the great playwrights who composed these works in a competition, who presented them before the Athenian public, and attendance at these dramatic festivals was a civic duty. As a citizen, you were expected to come. Aeschylus was a citizen himself. In fact, on his tombstone, he had the following written. This tomb the bones of Aeschylus doth hide, Euphorion's son, fair Gela's pride. How famed his valor Marathon may tell, and long-haired Persians who knew it all too well. Now, in other words, if I were Aeschylus, wouldn't I want in my tomb that I wrote the Orestia and I won all of these competitions? Not him. All he wanted remembered about him was that he had fought as an Athenian soldier at the great battle of Marathon against the Persians.
and that he had killed many a Persian in that battle. That was his pride in being an Athenian and being a warrior. But he was also a poet of remarkable sensitivity. And the supreme statement of his art was the Oresteia, the plays about Orestes. That is what it means. The plays about Orestes. And they are the only example coming down to us from the classical world of a set of three plays, a trilogy all put on at the same time. And they center around what happened to Agamemnon. You remember Agamemnon from our lecture on the Iliad. Agamemnon, who was commander-in-chief of the great army that sailed against Troy. But remember, how did he get to Troy? When the winds wouldn't blow, what did he do? He offered up his own daughter in sacrifice, because that's what the gods said through a prophet, through a soothsayer. They said to Agamemnon, if you want to lead this great host against Troy, you must offer up an innocent victim, your daughter. And so he brought his daughter there to the camp, lied to the mother, said, I'm going to marry her to the great hero Achilles, lied to the girl, and then when she got there, remember, they put her to death as a sacrifice to make the winds blow. But the winds did blow properly. He got to Troy, and although it took 10 long years, Troy was conquered. And our play begins when Troy has just been conquered, the first of the three plays, the Orestes story, centering around the plays Agamemnon, the Libation Bearers, and the Eumenides. But we start with the Agamemnon, the first of the plays. And the Agamemnon begins when Troy has been captured. And there is an old watchman on a roof looking for a signal. For as soon as Troy is taken, then a beacon will be lit at Troy. And a beacon a few miles on, and a few miles on, and a few miles on, until the light carries it all the way to Mycenaean Greece, that this great city has been taken. And the watchman, worn out with waiting, old, hurting in his bones, finally sees this great beacon. And he rushes there to the house and palace of Agamemnon, where in his absence, his wife, Clytemnestra, the mother of the slain girl, Iphigenia, has been ruling in his stead. But it is a gloomy palace. For outraged at what her husband has done, at the slaughter of their daughter, Clytemnestra has taken a lover. And not just any lover, but in fact, the son who has come down from another terrible crime. For the father of Agamemnon, Atreus, outraged that his brother had seduced his wife, pretended to forgive the brother, but instead invited him to a feast where he served up to his own brother his nephews and nieces. In other words, he took this man's children and slaughtered them, turned them into stew and turned them into shish kebab. And unknowing, their father ate them. Only one survived. Now, what is such an act? Certainly it's wrong to seduce your sister-in-law, I suppose. But Atreus, the father of Agamemnon, had responded in a fashion that lacked moderation, hadn't it? In fact, it was hubris. Remember our great value of hubris? Outrageous arrogance. And the slaughter of these innocents. So the surviving son is all too willing to become the lover of Clytemnestra. And together they have reigned over Mycenae. But no word of this has reached Agamemnon. The people of Mycenae and are too cowed. They are too, terrified. So Agamemnon comes home then in our play, bringing with him his mistress, Cassandra. The prophet, doomed by Apollo to know the truth and never be believed. And so Agamemnon arrives, pride swelling out of him in his war chariot. And his wife comes up to him and says, darling, so wonderful to have you home. I have missed you all these years. And again, townspeople, the chorus of old men there from Mycenae in the town of Argos, they just sit there. Oh. And Agamemnon says, Here I am. This is my mistress, Cassandra. Take good care of her.
Darling, of course. We have just waited for you. Let us welcome you as a mighty conqueror should be welcomed. I have rolled out literally a red carpet.
Oh, I don't know if I should walk on a red carpet, says Agamemnon. That might seem a little smacking of hubris. This is a man who's already killed his own daughter, but he's worried about hubris, stepping on a red carpet.
Darling, for a hero as mighty as you, hubris can be nothing.
Well, all right, I'll walk on it, I suppose. Now I want to take a bath. So they go inside.
And there inside, no sooner is Agamemnon in his bathtub, that his wife and her lover wrap him in a net and smash his brains out with a battle axe. And he screams, helpless, "What? And Cassandra, too, must die. Now, she has done nothing except be taken as a captive, but she must die, too. And so Clytemnestra and her lover kill Agamemnon and kill his mistress. "Now my daughter is avenged," says Clytemnestra. "This is not murder. This is execution. Are you following me? Do you think you should kill your daughter, yes or no? That man killed our daughter as a charm against the winds. That is how much he thought of her. And her voice cries out to me from the grave. Mother, avenge me. Nobody else will. Should a mother not avenge her daughter? Is that not justice?" "Oh, yes." And so the play ends with Clytemnestra and her lover boldly proclaiming that they will rule on in Argos and in Mycenae. The play comes to its end. Two children have been left behind of the union of Clytemnestra and Agamemnon, Orestes the son and Electra the daughter. And Orestes is sent off far into exile. And the daughter, Electra, grows up there at the palace, day after day, knowing that her mother lives with the man who killed her father, growing older and sadder under this pain, and with her brother far away, not even there to share her grief. And she goes out every day to the tomb of her father, Agamemnon, and prays to him for help. "Daddy, come back and help us. This is a terrible situation in which mom is allowed to go free." She goes out one day and there's a little lock of a hair. And she picks it up. As we have ended our second play, the libation bearers, those who carry funeral offerings. She picks up this lock of hair and she looks at it and says, "Why, it looks just like my own hair. Well, let's compare it. Why, it is. It's just like my own hair." Could it be? No. No, he is so far. Could it be? Could my brother have come back? And up steps a handsome stranger with a friend and says, It is I, my darling sister. It is your brother Orestes. I have come back to you. Oh. Do you know what I have been through? I can only imagine. And I thought about you every minute in my own long exile, driven away from my own home by my own mother who killed my own father. And I have come back with my friend to take vengeance upon him. You're going to kill mom? I sure am going to kill mom. Good for you. Now let's see how we're going to do it. Well, I've been thinking about that, sister. Do you think he should kill his mom, by the way? Well, they are both absolutely in agreement about this. What I'm going to do is to go to the palace. See, you recognize me, but do you think my mother would recognize me? No, I don't think so. You're too changed. Yes, that's what I thought too. I'm going to go to the palace and tell her that my friend and I, we are strangers. We have come asking for hospitality. And on our way, we learned that Orestes, her son, had died. And we were bringing her that news. Excellent. But, you know, do you really think it's right for a son to kill his mother? I know it is right because the god Apollo told me to do it. I have been at Delphi. I went to the great oracle of the god Apollo at the very center of the earth,
where he speaks forth through his priestess. I have asked the God of sunlight and wisdom, what must I do? And he spoke to me and said, you must kill your mother. You must avenge your father's death. That is the duty of a son, to avenge his father. Don't you see, this is blood guilt. She has not just killed anyone, she has killed his father. And so, with the blessing of the god Apollo, I have come to take our vengeance. So the daughter returns to the palace, and a short time afterwards, these two strangers appear and present themselves to Clytemnestra. We come from afar, and I'm afraid we bring bad news. We have learned that your son Orestes is dead. Oh, yes, I guess that's bad news. Sorry to hear it, but he was gone for a long time. Please make yourself at home here in our palace. That is our duty as rulers over the land of Argos and Mycenae to take care of you. You don't know me, do you, Mom? But Orestes, my darling boy. Mom, I've come to kill you and your boyfriend. No, no. Don't you understand? I had to kill Agamemnon. He killed your sister. I don't care that he killed my sister. He was my father and you killed him, and I must take vengeance. The god himself has told me that. How could you kill our father? Because he killed your sister. You're not getting that point. And I've told you I don't care. Ah! And he kills a boyfriend like that, that little weasel. Sharing your bed all of these years like that, defiling my father's memory. And now you're going to die, Mom. Well, she grabs a battle axe. She's ready to fight him, but tosses it away and says, here, strike me in my womb. That's where you came from. Okay. Bah! And he drives it deep into Mom. And so Clytemnestra and her lover lie side by side in a pool of blood. And Agamemnon has now been avenged. So don't you think our play should end? But it doesn't. Because suddenly, as his sister embraces him, and the crowd now rushes up. Oh, that was a great thing to do. They were bad people. Clytemnestra, we knew that all along, and we're so glad you're back to rule over us. You look a little distracted. Ah, says Orestes, what is this? What? Oh, this is horrible. What? Don't you see him? Who? Don't you see them? Those snakes, those women, those awful women with the snakes coming out of their faces. Don't you see them? No. Oh my gosh. It's the Furies. The Furies. Those ancient divinities from the days before when Zeus ruled over the gods and goddesses, who have as their task the punishment of those who shed the blood of their kin. Well, you killed your mother. Yes, but the god told me to. It doesn't matter. You did the crime, and now you must pay the consequences. And the Furies will pursue you wherever you go. They're driving me crazy. I can't stand it. And he runs away, pursued by these Furies, like bloodhounds on a track. Everywhere he goes, they will go, giving him no rest. Well, do you think there should be rest for a man who killed his mother? You don't think that is wrong to kill your mother? You don't think in a category of absolute right and wrong? Well, first of all, you heard me lecture on the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. That's what it says. But these are Greeks, not Hebrews, okay? Thou shalt not kill your mother. Don't you think that would be a value acceptable in most places and in most times, yes or no? And after all, the mother was but taking vengeance for the murder of an innocent daughter. So Orestes, whatever the god told him to do, has done a crime. He, in fact, has committed hubris, outrageous arrogance, because he thought he was wise when he was not wise. He thought he knew that if Apollo told him that, it was right. Well, Apollo can tell you lots of things. Apollo's not taking the consequences for it. You are, Orestes. Once again, Argos and Mycenae are left in turmoil. Electra alone bearing all the responsibility. and her brother, driven insane, wanders through Greece. A pariah, a man who killed his mother, and is now trying to put the blame off on Apollo. And so our second play, The Libation Bearers, comes to an end. Why is it called The Libation Bearers? Why is it a funeral offering? Because Clytemnestra and her lover are offerings offered up to the ghost of Agamemnon, don't you see? They are the human sacrifices. Even as Iphigenia the daughter was a human sacrifice offered up to the gods so Agamemnon could become a conqueror. So our third play begins. It is called The Eumenides, The Blessed Ones. We'll return to that title, The Eumenides. And it opens at Delphi. And there is Orestes getting a little bit of tortured sleep there at the altar of the god Apollo. And the Furies, these horrible-looking creatures, and they smell awful. They smell like decay, these women with snakes for their faces. They lie just outside the sacred boundary of the temple, surrounding it, waiting for him to move so they can be upon him and destroy him. He wakes up. I cannot endure this anymore, says Orestes. I cannot endure this pain anymore. Please, God Apollo, give me an end to my suffering. Bring it to a close. I think what you must do, says Apollo, is go to Athens and stand trial. Athens? What does Athens have to do with it? Well, of course, Athens is where our audience is watching. And Apollo explains to the audience, which loves to hear this, Athens is always the citadel of justice, of fairness. You go to Athens and there place yourself before an Athenian jury and have them try this case. Are you guilty of murder? And if they clear you, then the Furies should leave you alone. And I'll tell you what, I'll be your attorney. I'll do it for free. So let's go off to Athens and have this case tried once and for all. Orestes thus goes to Athens and appears before an Athenian jury of 500. That is how large their juries were. And the 501 person is the goddess Athena herself, the warrior goddess, the war goddess of wisdom, the patron divinity of the Athenian people. And Orestes puts his case forward. I killed the murderer of my father. I executed her because the god Apollo told me to do so. And the Furies are his prosecutors. And they stand up and say it doesn't matter. He still killed his mother. And that is a wrong act. And we are duty-bound to follow him. Do you see how everybody is duty-bound in this? Agamemnon has been duty-bound to offer up his daughter in sacrifice, Iphigenia. Clytemnestra has been duty-bound to avenge her daughter. Orestes has been duty-bound to avenge his father. And the Furies are duty-bound to avenge Clytemnestra. Everybody is caught in this web of duty and of fate tumbling down upon them. And are they not just automatons going through this suffering? Apollo then speaks out and says, well, I'm his attorney. And he did not murder his parent. What do you mean he didn't murder his parent? Well, you see, now this, I know this is hard to understand, but I want you to ponder this. Only the father is the parent. The mom is not the parent. What do you mean the mother's not the parent? I say this to you, Athena. I want you to listen to this carefully. What the father does is plant his seed in this woman. And he is fully responsible for the seed. And all she does is provide a little house for it until it is born. Aha, you're scoffing there. Well, Athena, you understand this because did you have a mom? I did not, as a matter of fact. I sprang full-blown from the head of Zeus. I never had a mother. And I'm going to tell you something else, men of Athens, because only men attend these performances. And women are passive citizens. That is to say, they have rights as Athenian citizens, rights about receiving legacies and things, but they do not vote, and they are very much excluded from life as a whole, the public life of Athens. And I'm going to tell you something else, men of Athens. I will always be on the side of men against women. Yes, indeed. Always on their side. So you are now freed of any blood guilt. Go back home to Argos and Mycenae. Be with your sister and enjoy the rest of your life. Your troubles and travails are over, and you are now liberated and find your salvation. Well, the Furies are outraged. No, you can't let him go. Nobody will pay any attention to us anymore. It was our duty, and now you've stopped us from doing our duties. Well, I'll tell you what. How would you like to be honored by everybody forever? Ooh, that doesn't sound bad. And lose this terrible name, the Furies. Is that a nice name to have? Wouldn't you like to be called something like the Eumenides, the Blessed Ones? Oh, that's so much nicer. And Athens will create for you a lovely shrine. And you will be here, the Blessed Ones, honored and revered by the Athenians. Well, that's not a bad bribe, is it? All right. Goodbye, Orestes. Your troubles are over. And so our play comes to an end, and the cycle has been fulfilled. Now tell me something. First of all, about public and private crimes. Can you separate here the murder of the daughter? Is that a private act by Agamemnon, or is it a public act? Well, you might say it's part of his policy to sail to Troy. But does that policy then justify an action that is murder, which is a private act? There is no separation of private and public morality. What the leader does privately is part of that same character that acts in public. So Agamemnon was a murderer. Clytemnestra was a murderer. Orestes was a murderer. And yet, is murder ever justified? Well, what is war but one grand murder? So it's not quite that easy, is it? And are these figures fated to do these actions? Because we have already seen blurred here any distinction between good and evil. Either is absolutely good not to kill your mother, or then we blur every distinction and it becomes simply a matter of the circumstances. And the circumstances made it right for Agamemnon to kill his daughter, for Clytemnestra to kill him, and for Orestes to kill him. And did any of them have to do these things? For Aeschylus, the profound issue was fate. And are you fated to carry out these actions? Was Agamemnon driven by fate and without any choice had to offer up his daughter? The answer is no. He could have said, no, I'm not going to offer up my daughter in sacrifice. I don't care what the divinities say. I'm going home and I'm not going to lead this expedition. And Clytemnestra. Did she have to kill her husband? No. She made the choice to kill him. She made that decision. In the same way that Orestes could have said, I will not kill my mother. No, every one of these actions was a deliberate choice. And the tragedy of a Greek play rest upon the fact that we put ourselves in these situations. Now, the gods may make it look tempting. Apollo may say, you are ordered to kill your mother. The same way that an SS captain could tell his soldiers, you are ordered to shoot down these people. But you can say, no, this is a bad order, and I will not follow it. But none of them said that. And so the cycle of blood and vengeance went on. Why? Because, in the words of Aeschylus, we only learn wisdom through suffering. That is a line I will repeat to you again and have said to you already. Every generation, every individual must, through their own suffering, in the mind of Aeschylus, find the wisdom to live their life.